The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Avery Schmitz, intern at Lawfare, with an episode from the Lawfare Archive for March 18, 2023. President Biden's approval of the Willow Project, a controversial, large-scale drilling venture in northern Alaska, has reignited scrutiny of federal policy in the Arctic. Willow has been widely criticized by environmental activists, and the circumstances surrounding its approval shed light on the geopolitical complexities of U.S. policy in the high north. For today's archive episode, I chose an interview from February 24, 2020. In the episode, Lester Munson sat down with Jim DeNoy to discuss the extent to which climate change mitigation efforts dictate American strategic policy in the Arctic.
I'm Lester Munson, a senior fellow at NSI and the former staff director of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And today we'll be doing a deep dive with NSI visiting fellow and defense intelligence executive Jim DeNoy. Jim is a career intelligence officer with the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency and has worked in a variety of intelligence fields, including geospatial intelligence, current and crisis intelligence, long-term research, policy support, and foreign intelligence relationships. His tours of duty have included assignments in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, U.S. European Command, NATO, the FBI, and the White House. He is also the recent author of an NSI law and policy paper entitled The Arctic, Securing the High Ground. Jim, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Les, and I really thank George Mason University for allowing me to participate in this podcast. I would say, Les, everything you said was absolutely true. As of 2 weeks ago, I retired with 37 plus years in the intelligence community. My last day on the job was on 31 January. So this is sort of my coming out in terms of getting out and getting the message out. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're thrilled you're doing it here on Fault Lines. So why don't you give us a little bit more color about your background, some of the stuff you've worked on, and then what inspired you to write this paper on the Arctic?
Yeah, sir. I'm an analyst by trade. I've spent 37 years on the analytic side of the house in the intelligence community. I'm a Europe, Eurasia, NATO person. That's my focus area. And you can't look at Europe, Eurasia, and NATO without looking at the Arctic, because you have a number of countries, obviously Arctic states, and there are eight Arctic states. You've got Canada. You've got Denmark by virtue of its sovereignty over Greenland. You've got Finland. You've got Norway. You've got Sweden. You've got the United States, and you've got Russia. And five of those Arctic states are members of the Atlantic Alliance. So you immediately have to start focusing on the Arctic. Probably my interest peaked over a decade ago in 2007 when Putin decided to plant a flag at the bottom of the Arctic Sea in the Lomonosov Ridge. That was in August of 2007. And that was kind of an alarm bell there. It was kind of a wake-up call for some of us in the intelligence community. And so my job at the time, I was a defense intelligence officer for Europe, NATO, over the Pentagon, and said, hey, we've got to start looking at this as a long-term strategic issue. The fact of the matter is that the Arctic polar ice cap is shrinking. It is about from estimates anywhere from 4 to 6% of the Earth's surface is in the Arctic. And two of our most prime global competitors, Russia and China, are moving forward. You know, nature abhors a vacuum, and as that the polar ice cap shrinks, people are going to move in, and the degree of human activity is going to increase. So,
all right, so let's talk a little bit more about the, before we get into the policy issues, maybe the geography here. And this is not a National Geographic podcast or anything, so we're just talking about this in terms of how it impacts the policy. But the Arctic is not like the Antarctic. It's a different kind of place. Talk about just the physics of the high ground of the Arctic and what the ice cap means, what the fact that it's receding means, and then the various geographical features in the Arctic that are relevant for national defense issues here.
Well, yeah, if you look at Antarctica, for example, the big difference is Antarctica is its own continent. It does not touch upon land masses, either from a landmass perspective or a coastal perspective, on the number of countries that the Arctic does. And so you immediately have an issue in terms of sovereignty, country rights that really didn't exist in Antarctica when the Antarctica Treaty was devised in the 1950s. It was a lot easier for those countries to kind of declare and internationalize the Antarctic. That's really not the case. It's a lot more complicated in the Arctic. In fact, many people argue that the Arctic is not an ungoverned space. It's probably the most governed space on the planet, because right now each of the countries has their own laws, their own policies. The European Union is involved as well through virtue of the European Union's membership with a number of the Arctic states. So it's a quite different situation than we find in Antarctica.
So as the polar ice cap melts, it opens up new lanes for potential shipping traffic, for navies, for things like that. There's also energy resources at stake in the Arctic. I've seen numbers. I think there's a geological survey in 2008 that said somewhere between 16% and 30% of undiscovered energy resources on the Earth are in the Arctic. So how is that – talk about how that might be playing into some of the developments we're seeing today.
Well, it's absolutely right. They're estimated to have large natural resource reserves, both oil, natural gas. There's fishery issues involved too, because you've got fishing rights that are involved in the Arctic. So absolutely, there are economic drivers and potential economic benefits that are really at stake here. And you would certainly see that in the case of Russia and China, who really see the economic benefits involved in opening up those markets.
So two of the big geographical features in the Arctic are, this is my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, are the Northwest Passage, which is mostly between the north coast of Canada and the North Pole, and also the Northern Sea Route, which is above the Russian territory between Russia and the North Pole. So what can you talk a little bit about these two geographical features of the Arctic and what they mean for navies and for countries that are trying to exploit the Arctic?
Yeah, I think everybody recognizes that those are going to be the two main thoroughfares in the Arctic as these areas open up. As the ice cap recedes, these will become the transport arteries for commercial traffic. They will also open themselves up to potential military activity as well. The Russians recognize that. They've always recognized that. In fact, in their Russian Arctic strategy, which came out in 2008, they specifically lay out the fact that the Northern Sea Route is their main thoroughfare, and that they will do everything to assure that they have access and control over the Northern Sea Route. In terms of the Northwest Passage, Canada has declared for quite some time that they see this as an internal waterway. It is part of Canada. We do not recognize it. We, the United States, do not recognize that as an internal waterway with Canada. We see it as an international waterway. But these are the two main thoroughfares that are at play when we're talking about opening up the Arctic to commercial business and other activity.
Let's talk about Canada a little bit more. When I was reading your paper, the thing that struck me the most was the differences between the U.S. and Canada on Arctic issues. And of course, our interest, aside from the fact that we're kind of interested in things globally, is that Alaska is, of course, part of the United States, is in the Arctic Circle. And so the U.S. has a vested interest, a geographic interest in the Arctic Circle, not quite as big as Canada's, of course, but Canada's our closest neighbor. We collaborate with Canada on any number of issues. We, for the most part, share the same language. As you were pointing out earlier in our conversation, NORAD is both a U.S. and a Canadian entity. It's a joint operation. Canada is one of the Five Eyes. It's as close of an ally as there is, even probably closer than our special relationship with the United Kingdom, is we're close to Canada. And yet, we have a real difference in the Arctic. Can you talk a little bit more about the way Canada sees the Arctic and the Northwest Passage, and how that impacts U.S. and Canada relationship as vis-a-vis the Arctic?
Yes, Canada is probably, in my view, the key to future cooperation in the Arctic for a lot of the reasons that you laid out, Les. And we do have differences. We do have differences in terms of the status of the Northwest Passage. We do have currently kind of a modus vivendi with the Canadians on that dates back to the Reagan administration, in which we will sort of ask the Canadians, notify them if we wish to have a ship pass through the Northwest Passage, and they will escort us through. That was kind of kicking the can down the road for many, many years, as long as the Northwest Passage was essentially inaccessible. It really didn't become an issue. But as the ice melt, as the cap recedes, this is going to become more and more of an issue. And the issue in the status of the Northwest Passage and a disagreement between the United States and Canada on that issue is going to become more and more pronounced. Now, the Canadians recently issued a new Arctic strategy late last year, in which they were very clear, in which they reaffirmed the fact that they view the Northwest Passage as Canadian, as an internal waterway.
So I did a little bit of research. You know, the last time we invaded Canada was during the Madison administration. That was a long time ago. Things have gotten a lot better since then. But the current administration, President Trump, has had occasionally a testy relationship with Canada. We've imposed tariffs on some of their products I don't think they were expecting at all. And there's been a little bit of hostility in the conversation. Nevertheless, we remain very close to them. In terms of defense policy, foreign policy, and some other things. Have you seen, and I'm not asking you to get into politics necessarily at all unless you want to, but have you seen anything in the current administration that makes you think that we're not going to be able to resolve these questions between the U.S. and Canada on policy issues in the Arctic?
I think there's a lot of work to be done. I think we can resolve them. Canada is a good friend of ours, but we have to begin that discussion, because I think any comprehensive U.S. Arctic strategy is going to have to involve cooperation with the Canadians. Already, we do have good cooperation with them. The United States Coast Guard and the Canadians cooperate. The Canadian Navy and the U.S. Navy have a history of cooperation. So the foundation is there. I think we can work it out. I think there's mutual benefits for us to move forward in greater cooperation with the Canadians on the Arctic on a whole number of fronts, whether it's environmental issues, defense and security issues, economic issues. And so I'm optimistic. I believe that we can come to an agreement on that. And I really think, as I lay out in my paper, I think we're really going to need to talk to the Canadians seriously about the entire issue of the status of the Northwest Passage. I think we could actually get really good concessions with the Canadians on that issue if we be as so bold as to maybe even recognize the Canadian sovereignty over the Northwest Passage. I know that's going to be extremely controversial, but I think if we play our hand right, we could probably get some guarantees in terms of access rights and et cetera and other benefits that would be very, very, very fruitful for both us and the Canadians.
So you see a way forward there. That's encouraging, because it does seem like that's potentially the biggest roadblock to the U.S. implementing perhaps a more robust Arctic strategy going forward.
Yeah, it's the elephant in the room, and you may have heard, you know, Secretary Pompeo at one of the last Arctic Council meetings did mention the whole issue of both the Russians claiming sovereignty over the Northern Sea Route and the Canadians over the Northwest Passage as issues that we, the United States, don't recognize.
All right. So you talked about the elephant in the room. Let's talk about the bear in the room. Russia has more than 50% of the land claims in the Arctic Circle. Your paper notes with some alarm that Russia's taking a lot of steps to militarize the Arctic and putting a lot more assets up there. Can you talk about that? And what is it that Russia is doing specifically in the Arctic that is of concern to us right now?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen this really beginning in the second administration of Putin's presidency in 2007, as I mentioned before, when they put their flag in the Arctic seabed in the Lomonosov Ridge in 2007, and then they issued their comprehensive Russia Arctic strategy document in 2008. You know, the Russians have not been coy or secretive about what their plans are for the Arctic. If you read their strategy document, if you look at their actions, it's quite clear that they want to ensure that they assert control over the vital Northern Sea Route. That's probably the primary driver behind that. And it explains their behavior, I think, very clearly. They have refurbished a lot of the old Cold War military bases that were there. They're putting more air defense assets in the region. All of these are designed so that they could assert control, what we would call on the defense side, area access and area denial capability, A2AD capability, that would allow them to control that transit route. That is the absolute vital interest that they have. Right now, I think most people who are looking at it can put this and say, well, these are somewhat defensive actions on the part of the Russians. But we are concerned, and we need to establish, I think, clear red lines in the Arctic and ensure that whatever the Russians do in that area do not cross the line in terms of trying to assert control over areas where they are vital to the United States and our NATO allies. So we need to monitor very, very, very carefully.
So one of the things we'll get into, I think, towards the end are your policy recommendations for the U.S. One of the most notable facts in your report is that the U.S. only has two icebreaker ships. So we'll get to that in a second. But the Russians have significantly more icebreaker ships, which are a requirement to do a lot of the things that they're trying to do in the Arctic. How many do they have? What are they doing with them? What are the trend lines for their naval presence in the Arctic?
They have about 46 or so. These are U.S. Coast Guard figures themselves. Now, they vary as much because you really have to take into consideration particular icebreakers. Are they fully operational at any period in time? But they have about 46 icebreakers of all various types, six of which are nuclear-powered. And the Russians are the only country on the planet that has nuclear-powered icebreakers. And as you noted, Les, yeah, the United States has two operational icebreakers. One heavy icebreaker and one medium icebreaker.
So that's a real challenge for us. All right, let's talk about China. And at a certain point here, I want to get to the NATO question. But before we get there, let's talk about China. China's not an Arctic country. It's not in the Arctic Council. It's not one of the eight countries that are part of that international organizational mechanism. But it's got ambitions. China's been undermining U.S. interests in the Arctic almost directly for a little while now. Talk about what China's doing in the Arctic and where it wants to go.
Well, you're right. They're not a formal member of the Arctic Council, which was formed in the 1990s. They do have observer status as of 2013, and they're pushing very hard to move forward from observer status, and they'd like to have full voting status in the Arctic Council. Beijing saw, I think, a big opening in the early 2000s with the financial crisis in Iceland. Iceland went essentially bankrupt. Nobody was going to loan them any money. The Chinese came in with some financial incentives, and they've used their relationship with Iceland is kind of a wedge to establish a foothold in the Arctic region. They also have been very aggressive in using scientific expeditions up in the Arctic to what we would call gain domain awareness as to how to operate in the Arctic.
So they're not just doing science at those science research facilities. That's pretty sure.
You know, scientific expeditions serve multiple purposes, and they do have military applications as well, because you get to learn how they can operate, what the difficulties are to operate in the Arctic, and that information is very useful on many different fronts, including on the defense and security front.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Okay, so we've talked about Russia, China, Canada, big countries with big interests in the United States and their roles in the Arctic. Let's talk about NATO. Of course, Canada and the United States are in NATO. Some of the other countries in the Arctic Council are in NATO. Russia and China are not. What are the geopolitics here between NATO and Russia, and then between NATO, Russia, and China? How do we kind of pull that apart and see where the fault lines, as it were, between these different entities?
Well, I think in terms of NATO, I think we can all agree that NATO's kind of been slow in reacting to what the situation is in the Arctic. There are a number of reasons for that, not the least of which the internal dynamic in NATO itself. Historically, the Canadians have been quite wary of having NATO involved in Arctic issues. This is because the high north in the Canadian North, for them, is a very sensitive issue. They'd rather deal with that internally. They're not very anxious to have it and become a NATO issue. This has been in contrast to, let's say, countries like Norway, which has been agitating for quite some time to define a clear role for NATO in what they call the high north. So internal NATO dynamics have been at work, which have really prevented the alliance to kind of take a serious and comprehensive look at the Arctic and defining NATO's role. That's changing. That's changing because China is becoming much more active on the European continent, much more active in the Arctic. And this has alarmed a number of our NATO allies. And so we're really at a point where NATO as an alliance is talking more and more about, you know, what the role it needs to have and define. I think that culminated in 2018, where NATO had a very large military exercise called Trident Juncture, in which this was the largest exercise that NATO has ever had in the Arctic. So they're slowly moving toward addressing the Arctic as a security issue. Having said that, there is no NATO-Arctic strategy. The Arctic is not mentioned in the strategic concept document of NATO, which is wholly outdated and needs to be revised. I believe now there is discussions about carving out a NATO-Arctic strategy, which I think is good. That's one of my recommendations. I think they need to do that. NATO is going to have to increase its military exercise pace in the Arctic so that they can learn how to operate effectively in that harsh environment. And so in the meantime, how does Russia react to that? We need to balance. Nobody wants an increase in military tensions in the Arctic region. However, the alliance really needs to define the fact that it has interests in the region and that we need to ensure that Russia's military activity does not cross the line, so to speak.
All right, so this isn't a loaded question at all, but is it possible that there could be, you know, once NATO kind of gets its house in order and the U.S. and Canada come to more of a see eye to eye on some of these issues or find an accommodation and a way forward on the Northwest Passage and sovereignty issues, and you get something that looks more like a comprehensive NATO strategy, is NATO going to be collaborating with Russia to keep China out of the Arctic, or is it that NATO is going to be maybe working with China to mitigate against Russian influence in the Arctic? Where is this thing going? All right, it might be a little bit of a loaded question.
No, it's a very good question. I think it's one of the key questions that we're going to have to deal with. I believe, personally, we need to make a key distinction between Russia and China. Russia is an Arctic nation, and as you mentioned, 50% of the Arctic coastline is above Russia. China is not an Arctic state, even though in their Arctic strategy that they published in 2018, they call themselves a near Arctic state, which is an interesting distinction. My personal feeling is that it's a distinction, a meaningless distinction. You're either an Arctic state or you're not an Arctic state. In fact, people have pointed out that the closest point of China to the Arctic is about 900 to 1,000 miles.
Well, we are all on the same planet, right? So we're all kind of near the Arctic.
So it's a good narrative. It's a clever sort of strategic communications effort on the part of the Chinese, but they're not an Arctic state. And so we need to address the Russia challenge and the China challenge in two different ways. We are going to have to find ways to sort of find and build confidence-building measures with the Russians as it deals with the Arctic. China, maybe not so much. I think we've seen what the Chinese have done in other areas where they've moved in Africa and other regions, in terms of their Belt and Road Initiative. And it's been one of economic exploitation and environmental damage. So it does not serve the U.S. interest to have, in my view, a larger Chinese presence in the Arctic.
So I noted this in one of our earlier Fault Lines episodes. I think Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in a speech two or three weeks ago, basically said that the U.S. is looking for places where it can collaborate with Russia on foreign policy and national security issues. Is this one of those?
I believe it is. I'm not Pollyannish about it. I've spent my entire career looking at the Russians and what they've done around the world. They are a challenge, and they have violated international law in their invasion of Ukraine and seizure of Crimea. So I'm not Pollyannish one bit in terms of what Moscow has done and what it's capable of doing. But I believe in the Arctic there are areas regarding search and rescue. I think there's areas of cooperation in terms of preserving the environment in the Arctic that we can come through the Arctic Council and even through the NATO-Russia Council when we're dealing with security issues with Moscow. So I believe part of our overall strategy needs to be, hey, how can we reach out and devise and enhance and follow through on confidence-building measures with Russia in the Arctic? We don't want the Russians and the Chinese to get closer together on the Arctic. So we need to sort of keep the Russians close to our vest. Contrary, the Russians need investment. Their strategy is totally dependent on foreign investment. And the Chinese have money to spend, and they have ambitions to spend. So this is something we're going to have to look at very, very closely.
All right, let's talk about Greenland. Greenland's been in the news a few months ago when President Trump famously, I think on Twitter, tried to buy Greenland from Denmark. It didn't work. And a lot of people kind of laughed about it and thought it was kind of silly. I think we had to cancel a state visit because of that little controversy. But, you know, notably, some smart folks, and I would include Senator Tom Cotton in that, who the senator from Arkansas, who is no dummy, said, you know what, there's some real issues here, and the U.S. has an important role in Greenland, and we need to see about expanding it. And in fact, that's going on. There's increasing U.S. cooperation with Denmark in Greenland on the military side and in some other areas. What's the how does Greenland play into the conversation we've been having about the role of China in the Arctic?
Well, Greenland is in China's sights. There's no doubt about it. Greenland is very important regarding China's overall strategy to, again, establish a solid foothold and presence in the Arctic. Why is that? Why is that so? Well, you know, Greenland has a degree of self-rule that Denmark lent them. China's looking to the future of potential independence of Greenland, and they see an opening there economically to sort of get Greenland to be closer to China in that regard. In fact, a while back, the Chinese had made a very ambitious proposal to build a couple of airports and improve the infrastructure up in Greenland. We got so alarmed, as well as the Danes, that we were able to counter that offer and ensure that the Chinese did not get those contracts. I thought that was a good move. So I think, you know, the president was right in the sense of looking at Greenland as a potential battleground, so to speak, between us and the Chinese. We have an air base, Thule Air Base in Greenland. Greenland has always served an important security role during the Cold War. And now in the new era of increased human activity in the Arctic, which will proceed in the years and decades ahead, I think Greenland is going to be very important to our overall strategy.
So this next question gets a little bit beyond the scope of your paper, but we've mentioned two places now where there are economic challenges that were exploited by China: Iceland and Greenland. And Iceland, very different situations. Iceland had a banking crisis. Greenland simply undeveloped, and Denmark doesn't seem to be investing the kind of resources in Greenland that you would need to invest to really promote development in a more modern way. China's exploiting those opportunities, and it has a direct impact on our national security interests in the Arctic. Should a economic development strategy be included in an Arctic strategy? Granted, it may not be in a whole bunch of countries in sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America, kind of the usual suspects you think of for economic development, but should we have an economic development component in our Arctic strategy if we're to do a whole-of-government approach?
Yeah, I think you need a multifaceted approach in this. You know, the issues that we're dealing with in the Arctic span all the elements of national power: diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. And so you need to have a comprehensive strategy that addresses each one of those elements of national power. Certainly the Russians and the Chinese, if they were to use our dime concept that we have, diplomatic, informational, military, and economic, they're looking at the Arctic through each one of those prisms. And so for us to have a comprehensive strategy to address both the Chinese and Russian actions, we need to have them across the board.
All right, let's get into the details of U.S. Arctic policy and who implements it a little bit more. The Coast Guard is the lead agency for dealing with the Arctic. It's been that way for, my understanding, is 150 years. Coast Guard is, of course, an armed service of the U.S. government. It's part of the Homeland Security Department. So it's a little bit limited in what it can do, but it's been running point for us in the Arctic for a long time. The Department of Defense is starting to become more interested. How do you see the U.S. kind of bureaucratic politics responding to the challenges in the Arctic? Are we doing everything we possibly can, or is there some place where we need to maybe quicken our pace a little bit?
Well, we're playing catch up. There's no doubt about it, I think. But we do have the foundational work is there, really beginning in the last days, if not hours, of the Bush administration in 2009, when President Bush issued a presidential executive directive on the Arctic, which really declared that the United States is an Arctic nation. many people maybe don't realize that or don't think about it from day to day, but we are an Arctic nation by virtue of Alaska. So that sort of put that out there. That was followed up by the Obama administration issuing a comprehensive Arctic strategy in 2013 and 2014. What we see is efforts to kind of bring together at the interagency level a way to address the Arctic challenge. But these efforts have been sort of disparate and uneven across the board over the past 10 plus years. What we do have now is a number of organizations are now issuing their own Arctic strategies. As you mentioned, the U.S. Coast Guard has their own Arctic strategy. The Navy has their strategy as well. But I think what we need to do is come up with a sort of chapeau to bring all of these kind of disparate strategies together and because we're going to need to have a, as you mentioned, a whole of government, and I would argue a whole of society approach to the issue. I think first we have to do, one of the things we have to do is raise the American people's consciousness that this is an important issue. We have a lot of issues that can kind of distract us on this, but we need to play the long game on this. We're not talking about, we're not going to turn the ship around tomorrow or even next year. This is a multi-year, multi-decade approach that we're going to have to take. That's certainly how our adversaries, our competitors, view this. Both the Russians and Chinese look at this. They're playing the long, long game in the Arctic, and we need to play the long game in the Arctic as well. Human activity is going to increase. The level of human activity is going to increase in the Arctic. And with that come a whole host of challenges across the board, economic challenges, political challenges, military and security challenges. And we need to be prepared for that.
Terrific. What are some of the specific steps that can be taken now to start to fill that gap? We talked about icebreakers. The U.S. has two. The Russians have as many as 46. I believe even the Chinese, according to your paper, have 6 icebreakers. They're not even an Arctic nation. So it seems clear that we should be building more icebreakers so that we can have better access to these resources. What other steps should we be taking?
Well, we definitely have what I call an icebreaker gap. I mean, you remember in the Cold War, we had a bomber gap.
The missile gap.
We had a missile gap. Yeah. Both turned out to be erroneous. But I think all of us agree that we do have an icebreaker gap that we need to address. There's no way that we can have a credible and persistent presence in the Arctic without building a viable icebreaker fleet. Now, you know, the Coast Guard, in cooperation with the Navy, has come up with their polar security cutter program, which foresees the construction of at least 3 heavy icebreakers over the next number of years. The first one is supposed to be the construction of the first one is supposed to be in 2021, with its commissioning in 2024, but this is just a drop in the bucket, so to speak, in terms of what we need. It's a step in the right direction. But we really do need to have a more aggressive program to do that. The Navy, for its part, reactivated the Second Fleet, and it became at least initial operation capability last year. It has responsibility for the North Atlantic and the Barents Sea and what we call the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap, which was well known during the Cold War days in which Soviet submarines operated in. But the Navy's Arctic strategy, if you see it, is quite frankly, it was met with shrugs. It's some people criticize it as a rather anemic kind of approach to the Arctic, but it's a step in the right direction, but they really need to do more about it and define more clearly what the Navy's role is going to be in the Arctic in cooperation with the Coast Guard and our allies, as I mentioned before. And this is why Canada and NATO need to play a, a key role in our strategy.
Well, we let Canada win the NBA championship last year, the Toronto Raptors. So I think they owe us one. That might be the beginning of a good
indeed
conversation between the two countries. All right, is there anything, Jim? Is there anything else that you think we should be talking about vis-a-vis the Arctic before we close this out today?
Well, let me go back to a couple of things. First, we need a whole of society approach. I believe we need to raise the American public's consciousness as to what the importance of the Arctic is. You know, in military strategy, seizing the high ground and maintaining the high ground is key to victory. This is something that Sun Tzu recognized back in the 6th century in the Art of War. And there's no higher ground on planet Earth than that of the Arctic. So we need to recognize and appreciate the fact that we are an Arctic nation. Canada is going to play an important role, and I think we need to resolve our differences such as they are with the Canadians on the Arctic and move forward in a comprehensive joint approach to dealing with the multitude of challenges that will result in increased human activity in the Arctic. We need to be, as we've always been, the leader of the Atlantic Alliance, and we need to bring forward to NATO and push forward with NATO to develop its own comprehensive Arctic strategy, which recognizes both the opportunities and the challenges that come with increased human activity in the Arctic. We need to devise a way to recognize that Russia has a legitimate role in the Arctic as the largest Arctic nation, and while at the same time ensuring that Russia doesn't overstep its bounds and encroach upon the legitimate security needs and requirements of the United States and our allies.
It's almost like a microcosm for all of our foreign policy issues.
And I really think we really need to take on the China challenge. And this is an area where I believe we can find common ground with both our Canadian friends, our European friends, and the Russians in that regard. The Chinese have their own interests. The Chinese are looking at, they want to be a global player. They see it as part of their overall economic strategy. But as we've seen before, that poses a lot of challenges to the United States, and they're not necessarily in the U.S. national interest.
Are the geopolitics of the Arctic a topic that is only going to get hotter? Jim, thank you very much for joining us. Oh, this is a great topic. I really appreciate your spending some time and discussing these things a little more in depth with us. As always, Fault Lines is produced by the National Security Institute. Find out more about the Institute at nationalsecurity.gmu.edu. If you have any topics you'd like us to cover in the future, send us an email at nsi@gmu.edu. If you like what we are doing here, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so that more people can find our show. We'd like to thank Claude Jennings for engineering our episode today and Grant Haver for providing production and research assistance. We'll see you next time on Fault Lines.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.